Yukteshu. To beneficial activities. Evam. Thus. Pramatasya. Being inattentive. Kutumbha. To kith and kin. Asakta. Attached. Chetasaha. Consciousness. Astasada. Arrived. Saha. That. Vai. Certainly. Kalaha. Time. Yaha. Which. Apriyaha. Not very pleasing. Priyoshitam. For persons attached to women. Translation, thus King Puranjana, being attached to fruitive activities, karma, kandya, as well as kith and kin, and being obsessed with polluted consciousness, eventually arrived at that point not very much liked by those who were overly attached to material things. You can repeat, thus King Puranjana.
Being attached to fruitive activities,
karma, kandya,
as well as kith and kin,
and being obsessed with polluted consciousness,
eventually arrived at that point,
not very much liked,
by those who were overly attached
to material things.
So purport by His Divine Grace, Śrīla Prabhupāda, Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai.
In this verse, the words Priya Yoshitam and Apriyaha are very significant. The word Yoshit means woman, and Priya means dear or pleasing. Death is not very much welcome for those who are too much attached to material enjoyment, which culminates in sex. There is an instructive story in this connection. Once, when a saintly person was passing on his way, he met a prince, the son of a king, and he blessed him, saying, "My dear prince, may you live forever." The sage next met a saintly person and said to him, "You may either live or die." Eventually, the sage met a brahmachari devotee and he blessed him, saying, "My dear devotee, you may die immediately." Finally, the sage met a hunter and he blessed him, saying, "Neither live nor die." The point is that those who are very sensual and are engaged in sense gratification do not wish to die. Generally, a prince has enough money to enjoy his senses. Therefore, the great sage said that he should live forever. For as long as he lived, he could enjoy life, but after his death, he would go to hell. Since the brahmachari devotee was leading a life of severe austerities and penances in order to be promoted back to Godhead, the sage said that he should die immediately so that he need not continue to labor hard and could instead go back to Godhead. Back home. A saintly person may either live or die, for during his life he is engaged in serving the Lord, and after his death he also serves the Lord. Thus, this life and the next are the same for a saintly devotee, for in both he serves the Lord. Since the hunter lives a very ghastly life due to killing animals, and since he will go to hell when he dies, he is advised to neither live nor die. King Puranjana finally arrived at the point of old age. In old age, the senses lose their strength. And although an old man desires to enjoy his senses, and especially sex life, he is very miserable because his instruments of enjoyment no longer function. Such sensualists are never prepared for death. They simply want to live on and on and extend their life by so-called scientific advancement. So, some foolish Russian scientists also claim that they are going to make a man immortal through scientific advancement. Under the leadership of such crazy fellows, civilization is going on. Cruel death, however, comes and takes all of them away despite their desire to live forever. This type of mentality was exhibited by Aranyakashipu, but when the time was ripe, the Lord personally killed him within a second. So, Yukteshvevam pramattasya katumbha sakta chetasaha asasara savai kalo so yo priya priya yo shatam. So, Om Agnata Vidanda Shah Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Meditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So, this is very succinctly stated in the Bhagavatam too, by Lord Rishavade, Nunam Pramatasha Kudte Vikarma Yalindriya Pritya Aprinoti. When one is very much engaged, Yadindriya Pritya, he actually considers the senses and the objects of the senses especially very dear, then he becomes crazy. Actually, pramata or pramada means extremely crazy. Of course, not crazy in the sense of a lunatic in this world, necessarily. Someone who thinks he's Napoleon or someone who thinks he's, you know, whoever, Jesus Christ or something like that, the lunatic asylum. But crazy in the sense that he thinks that this life is the all in all. And so what we find is that modern, as Prabhupada points out here about scientists, he talks about Russian scientists here, but that is the scientific theory now, or the prominent scientific paradigm, that everything comes from matter. That this life is all in all, and if you can arrange matter properly, then you can live forever. You know, you can adjust things, or you can take care of the chromosomes properly, then you won't get old. And they actually, I was reading about an experiment they did the other day. It was with a worm. And they did something with the worm's chromosomes, so the worm was able to live like 10 times normal, more than a normal worm life, somehow or other. So there's this theory, it basically underlying an assumption, axiomatic assumption. Of course, an assumption is axiomatic, and axiom is an assumption. So underlying Western civilization and Western science, that the creation is something that, or the material world is something that functions from down to up. What do I mean by that? It's a very interesting explanation. It means that basically you have subatomic particles, and of course the scientists have not discovered all the subatomic particles so far. In fact, they just got bewildered by one experiment. They fired a neutrino. I don't know if anyone's read about this stuff. In Europe, they fired a neutrino, and the neutrino appeared to go faster than the speed of light, and everyone's bewildered by it. And they're saying, what's happening with the laws of nature? You know, there's something going faster than the speed of light. Anyways, things happen that bewilder them, and scientific theories change all the time. But their philosophy is that everything that we see here occurs due to interactions of subatomic particles, which later are combined to atomic particles, which later combine to molecules, which later combine to other things. And so if you can analyze and mathematically calculate what's happening on the subatomic level, you can actually predict everything that's happening on what's called the macrocosmic level. So there's something called the microcosm and the macrocosm. The microcosm means like micro. You know, what's happening in a very small place or microscopic place. And the macrocosm means the whole universe. So this is their philosophy, that everything's from the down going up. And in other words, what's happening down there predicts what's happening up here. It's interesting, isn't it? So that is actually not a fact, because they don't take into account the factor of consciousness. And so an example may be given of a car. Like, you can analyze everything happening in a car's engine from a subatomic perspective. I mean, you can look at all the atoms and molecules and the little explosions happening within the cylinders of the car that cause the camshaft to turn. I'm not going to talk about a car today. Anyway, and go through the gears. So it starts with something small, isn't it? The function of a car starts with something very, very small, and then eventually you have the car moving. So you can analyze it from that perspective. But also, nothing would happen unless you had a person who turned the keys, you know, turned the key in the car and started the damn thing and designed it. So you have both things happening. Things are happening from below going up, and things are happening from above going down. But the scientists only take into consideration one direction, below going up. You understand? It's interesting. Interesting scientific perspective. That's it. And they deny anything that, or any evidence, even solid, concrete evidence, that belies or contradicts that particular theory. You know, anything that manifests, any evidence that manifests or displays something that happens beyond empirical observation, they deny it actually exists. I'll give you some examples of that. One is that, let's take the pyramids in Egypt. There's the Grand Pyramid. Some of the stones in the pyramid are 250 to 300 tons of weight. That's pretty heavy, isn't it? I mean, a ton is 2,000 pounds in America. And there's also an imperial ton. That's larger. I mean, that's a British measure of a ton. Anyway, so that's very heavy. I mean, 200 tons, 300 tons. I mean, even the airplanes, maybe they're 20 tons or something like that. The big 747s, 20 to 30 tons. So, and they can lift up to 100 tons. And then the biggest, up to about 20 years ago, there was no machinery that could lift more than 100 tons at one time. There was nothing. And nowadays they have some that can lift two or 300 tons or even more. So anyway, so let's take the pyramids. The pyramids, some of the stones are like 300 tons. And then if you go to South America, to some of the ancient civilizations there, some of them are like 350 tons. And so the Egyptologists or archaeologists or anthropologists, they ask the question, how did these stones get up there? And they're all perfectly fitting and everything like that. It's interesting. Interesting thing. So the scientists reply, well, they got up there because they employed a system of inclined planes. You know, they didn't have... I mean, obviously, they couldn't put trees together and have sort of a pulley system because there would be no trees that were strong enough. The only trees that are strong enough to hold that sort of weight are in the American West. You know, these giant, giant trees that are there. But anyway, so they didn't have metal. So the only thing they could have done was have a plane, an inclined plane. You understand a plane? Not an airplane. Like an inclined plane means like a gradual inclination, so you can push something up there. So they calculated that, and if they were actually going to push those stones up an inclined plane, it would take an inclined plane over 1 or 2 miles long. You know, even if they had like millions of Hebrew slaves. You know, you remember the Bible, where you had all the Hebrew slaves in Egypt. It would take. Anyway, they couldn't do it. In other words, you couldn't have an inclined plane 1 mile long because it would take more material than the pyramids themselves to make the plane. I mean, that would be an engineering feat unto itself to make the plane. So the scientists basically, they're bewildered. All these different stones, these giant stones up there on the top, you know, not on the bottom. They're on the top, and they just can't understand how the stones are there. And then they read some ancient literatures, and they talk about how by sound vibration the stones were moved, which is very similar to the system in the Vedic literatures that describe, you know, sound weapons. And like Prabhupada actually said in the beginning, citing from the Bible, where it says in the beginning was the Word. Prabhupada said in the beginning was sound vibration. By sound vibration, everything was created. Of course, we understand Om was the original sound within this world. So There's some writing that says that, and not only in Egypt but in South America too. There's writing that says that they played certain drums, recited certain mantras, whatever, and then the stones they were able to. One man was able to lift a 300-ton stone and just put it in place. And so, I mean, there's many examples of that where the scientists just really can't explain what happened. But they deny that there was some either subtle thing happening according to the laws of nature or some, let us speak of some spiritual thing happening. Of course, they deny the existence. Obviously, they deny the existence of the soul. And also the subtle body. I mean, there's many, many examples that they're proofs, even empirical proofs, that there's something that exists beyond the body. I mean, there was one story I just read about a lady. She was in a hospital and she was she died. She basically died. You know, either called OBE or an NDE. I'll describe what that is. OBE is out-of-body experience or near-death experience. And anyway, she left her body, and she was in the hospital, and then she was able to hover over the hospital, and she was in her subtle body, and she was able to see that someone had left a sneaker on some sort of ledge in the 12th story of the hospital, some high story in the hospital. And she told that story when she came back to consciousness, she came back to life, and there was no way she could have seen that, and eventually they, you know, seen that with her gross body or whatever. And eventually people went searching all over the hospital, and they found this sneaker left on the ledge. Somehow or other got there. Maybe someone was jumping off. I don't know. And they forgot to take their shoes with them when they jumped off the ledge. So the point, there's a lot of even concrete empirical evidence that there's something beyond the body, there's something subtle happening. For the scientists, they will deny that completely because it just goes against all their theories. Or what to speak of the findings in archaeology of human beings that existed millions and millions of years ago, which really go against all the theories of evolution. All the different manifestations of the theories of evolution would say that modern human beings only existed for the last, several tens of thousands of years. Before that, we were all like monkeys in the tree, or at least Homo sapien erectus or something. That means the first monkeys that walked, or modern, what they call Homo sapiens sapiens. Only existed for like 40,000, 100,000, whatever it is, years. I mean, all these crazy theories, whereas there's actually evidence that there's been human beings on this earth for millions and tens of millions or 20, hundreds of millions of years. Anyway, so, but the scientists are just not all of them, I mean, obviously, we're talking about the majority, are just determined to prove that there's nothing beyond this body. And really, you should just enjoy yourself as much as you can while you're in this body. And by the process of science, we're going to eventually be able to increase your material enjoyment. We're going to be able to allow you to live longer. But it's, like Prabhupada said, it's a post-dated check. Like if you give someone a post-dated check, I remember sometimes someone wanted me to give them money and they wanted to give me a post-dated check. I said, forget it. I'm not going to accept such a post-dated check. It has to be valid now or else I don't accept the thing. So anyway, Prabhupada commented on that it's a post-dated check. But yadindriya priti aprinoti. Why are they acting like that? Because their senses are so dear to them. I mean, the sense satisfaction is so dear, they become pramada, bewildered, completely bewildered. And an example of that in the Vedic context, it was a story that I think you all know. It's that once upon a time, the demigods and the demons, sons of Diti, got together and they wanted to churn the milk ocean. And there was some prediction that if you churn the milk ocean, you're going to get the nectar of immortality from it. Amrit, it's called. So they got together. You know, sometimes when there's some really important thing to accomplish that benefits both parties. Even enemies can work together. So they decided, let's work together and let's have, as the churning rod, the Mandara Mountain, and we'll use as the rope this Vasuki. And interesting story, the demons were so stupid. They thought we, when they were choosing who would get the head of Vasuki, the snake, or the tail, they chose the head because they thought the head's more auspicious than the tail. But with the snake, the head is less auspicious than the tail. Normally it's, you know, normally the tail is very inauspicious of any animal, or tail or the rear end or whatever of any animal is not so auspicious. But with the snake, the tail is much better than the head. Because the, first of all, the tail doesn't bite, doesn't emit fumes. You know, you, if anyone's a snake charmer, you know you grab them usually by the tail, and then you get the head, but you don't. You're very careful with the head. You hold the head so they don't bite you. Anyway, so the demons, they chose the head, and the head had a lot of fumes, you know. Bad breath. Snakes have bad breath. Poisonous breath. And so they were getting a little unconscious. And so the demigods had the tail. So they were churning. A lot of things came out of this milk ocean. I mean, there was Lakshmi who came out of the milk ocean, who was the consort of Narayan. There is Indra's elephant came out of the milk ocean. So many things. Poison came out of the milk ocean that Lord Shiva took. But eventually, Dhanvantari, who was the originator of the Ayurvedic system, came out of the milk ocean carrying the nectar of immortality. Not really immortality in a literal sense, but it allowed someone to live so long, they would live as long as the creation until Lord Brahma died. So it was a very long life, just like the demigods are called Amara. Amara means without death. Mara means death. Amara means without death. Just like in the story of Lord Buddha, he was tested by this person called Mara. I don't know if any of you know that story. No. Lord Buddha was tested in his... Mara means death, but also means the attractive features of this world which bring on death. Because Prabhupada said, the more one enjoys his senses when he's young, he'll actually want to die later on when he's old. Because it depletes the ojas, it depletes the energy of the body, the vitality of the body. So this Mara tested, it's an interesting story in Lord Buddha's life, tested Lord Buddha in many different ways, and eventually Lord Buddha was able to overcome Mara, or the desire to enjoy this world. So getting back to the story of the demons and the demigods, so they're churning the milk ocean, and this nectar, Amrit, comes out. And the demons didn't really live up to the deal they made with the demigods, because they made a deal that when it comes out, they would share it. It's like Prabhupada said, this thieves, they'll steal from someone, and all the thieves will get together, and let's divide it up honestly, they'll say to each other. It's kind of silly, you know, let's divide it up honestly. If they're already dishonest, how can it be honest? Maybe equally would be proper, but they actually say, let's be honest with each other, which is crazy. So the demons didn't live up to their end of the bargain, so they grabbed all this nectar, and there's a big pot, and the demigods were all bewildered. And the Supreme Lord, he understood what to do, because he understood that demons, that is people who are demoniacally inclined. And actually, even sometimes we see demigods become demoniacally inclined in this way, because Indra, of course, gets attracted and bewildered by the opposite sex, even has illicit relationships with sages' wives like Ahalya, who is the wife of Gotama Rishi, and then he gets in trouble because of that. So what happens, the demons got bewildered because the Lord appeared as the Mohini Murti incarnation. And so he just went in front of them and just like, they basically started dancing when they saw him. And when they saw him, he just, you know, anyway, he or she, as the case may be, wiggled a little bit, you know, and flashed his eyebrows or her eyebrows. And the demon's just like, huh? Forgot about immortality. It's quite interesting that, isn't it exactly what's happening here? That you forget about your mortality and your immortal soul when you engage in sense gratification. It just happens. You just not only man, woman things, but also even video games do that to you. You know, I don't want to just like talk about man, woman interactions. But you know, even one becomes absorbed in any sort of sense enjoyment, eating, or any of the senses. I mean, video games, I guess, is a combination of sight and hearing because you've got some sort of sound thing. I mean, there was one video game recently. I never got the name of it, some stupid video game. It just, Call of War or something like that. Warcraft, whatever it is, it just came out and made $100 million over the first weekend, more than any movie has ever made. So the kids are sitting, I mean, many of the parents complain, you know, my kids are just sitting here playing video games all day long. And so you forget about your real interest, your real self-interest in life. Nunam pramata kurate vikarma. Yadindriya priti aprinoti. Whatever sense you engage with your sense objects, it causes you to become bewildered. And, you know, of course, that's spoken about in the Gita. When you contemplate sense objects, you become attached. Attachment leads to lust. Lust leads to anger, etc. One becomes bewildered and falls down in the material whirlpool. So here, in this particular story that I'm telling, the demons, they just became bewildered and looked at Mohini Murthy and went, wow. Forgetting that they had the nectar. I mean, imagine that. You know, if I give you some medicine that said will cure your diseases, allow you to become young again, all your gray hair will go away, you'll grow your hair again. And then some girl walks in and you forget me. I've seen that happen with people, actually. That I'm talking to them about Krishna. You know, and they're very interested. They say, oh, Krishna consciousness, you know, very interesting. Like that, and then some girl walks in. It's like I don't exist anymore. Right. Hello, here I am. I said, would you be interested, if I put a sari on, would you be interested in talking to me? I've actually said that to someone one time. I said, you know, if I had a sari and had long hair and it was beautiful, you'd probably want to talk to me. Now you don't even see me anymore. So the demons, it was like that. And then this Mohini Murthy said to them, because the demons were fighting amongst each other as to who would have the nectar. Not only did they take it away from the demigods, but they didn't even want to divide it up honestly amongst themselves, which is interesting. So Mohini Murthy said, I will divide it up equally between all of you. And they said, yeah, we trust you. And basically, Krishna even spoke some philosophy to them. He said, you can't trust me. You can't trust, you know, an unchaste woman. You can't trust me. And they said, that's all right. We trust you. Because you're so beautiful. How could you not be trustworthy? Anyway, there's real bewilderment. And then, of course, Mohini Murthy gave it to the demigods, and one demon, Rahu, snuck in, you know, and she discovered him, or Krishna, it's he, discovered Rahu, and he cut him off by the neck. But Rahu had already drunk some of the nectar, so his top portion from the neck up became immortal, the rest of it died. And so there's a whole story there about Rahu swallowing the sun and everything after that, because he was so upset that the sun had told Mohini Murthy that he was a demon hiding in the whole line of the demigods who were getting the nectar. So anyway, so the purpose of my telling this story is to show how even the demons who are very intelligent, I mean, they're not just like aborigines or you know, like the cave dwellers in Europe, the Neanderthal man, you know, they were actually super intelligent. These demons are not stupid people. They just have one little problem. They don't like God. Besides that, I mean, sometimes they're pretty nice. I mean, like Ravana, he would give charity to the demigods and to the even worship the demigods, and he would give charity to the brahmanas. He was a very hospitable person. You know, if I were to go to Ravana and say, you know, please give me a donation, he'd give me a donation. Pretty good. So they weren't bad in that sense. They were actually, of course, Ravana wasn't that pious. He used to eat human beings. But many of the demons were pious, you know, like opening up hospitals and things like that. But they just didn't like God. It's like the scientists nowadays. And it's interesting how Prabhupada really focused on the scientists, you know, materialistic scientists, really focused a lot, because basically it's something like, you know, the demons in the demoniac planets, that they were good and appeared very respectable and intelligent in many ways, but they had that one fault. They were against God. And they were dedicating their whole life, their lives to defeating the devotees, like that. And you see many of the scientists like that. That's Hawkins, for example. Even though, obviously, you know, he's disabled in many ways, and he's being punished by God, or whatever. You know, basically, if someone is in that situation, they should be very enthusiastic to learn they're not the body, isn't it? I mean, if I was disabled and couldn't move or anything like that, I would be ecstatic to understand that consciousness would continue with death, and then I would get liberated from this situation, and then I could get a spiritual body. You know, wouldn't you? I mean, I would be like that. So even so, he's so determined to oppose theological understanding, a theological understanding, or God-centered understanding. So anyway, so the point is that demons are the ultimate motivation, because behind every philosophy, you know, demons have a philosophy too, or people who are against God, atheists. Let's use the word atheists instead of demons, because it's demons has so many connotations in the modern world that don't really fit what the demons were in the Vedic context. You understand? So let's use the word atheists, people who just like don't think that there's God, anything beyond this body. So the underlying motivation is they want to enjoy their senses. Like I always say, behind every philosophy, there's a psychology or a desire. So if you analyze, you know, if you analyze why people are atheists, you'll see in general it's they want to enjoy their senses, or they're so angry with God for putting them in that situation, like Hawkins, for example. You know, how could there be a God? I was put in this situation. They were so angry. Or you see people after World War II, many people became atheists because of seeing what happened in the concentration camps. You know, how they were angry with God. So there's a lot of anger there. So in other words, there's an emotional aspect, or let's say a foundation. There's an emotional foundation to their atheism. It's not simply some intellectual conclusion. So you can analyze that. When anyone has a philosophy, there's always an emotional foundation, or a foundation of their desire below their philosophy that's supporting their particular philosophy, like that. And so, you know, we have a Christian concept. What is our emotional foundation? We love Krishna. And also our philosophy, speaking logically, is so precise, concise, and bulletproof, as they say, that it can defeat all the atheistic philosophies. So we have the best philosophy, the best spiritual philosophy, and also we have the best desire too. We want to serve Krishna. We want to love Krishna. So any questions or comments about these things? Yeah. I would say no. for most of us. I mean, Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj, who was a scientist also, he spent some time, not so much trying to change the minds of them, but he found favorable scientists. And he published books with articles by favorable scientists. There are many scientists who agree that there's something beyond gross matter. So he would put... Why did he do that? Not so much to influence the scientists who are just completely determined that there's nothing beyond gross matter, but to influence people in general. Because this whole scientific understanding or paradigm is underlying modern civilization. You know, it's the underlying philosophy that, you know, basically a mechanistic viewpoint. And so we can destroy in people's minds that philosophical understanding. It's not a deep philosophy, I mean, but a philosophy, if we can show people they're different than the body, that there's actually karma and all these other things, there's a good chance people will change their ways. So that's why we preach, not to defeat them so much, because they will never admit defeat. They're determined. It's like Hiranyakashipu, he would never admit defeat when all the evidence was there right in front of his eyes that Prahlad Maharaj was being saved at every step. Okay, all glory to Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Vijay.